rather title it, and should have, and I was talking to Bob about this, so that's what's going to be entitled. The subject is really authority and submission, as we see from 1 Corinthians 11th chapter, not so much head covering, although that is involved. And this is not the end of the series. You notice that we started with the Lord's Supper, as I chose to do, to talk about the use of that and understand that God expects certain things of us. If we're going to be holy, if we're going to practice the things that He has given us to do, and to have the full effect of edification, you know, it will not do us good to do religious things. Only those things that build us up, that God has given us, will only be effective. And really, when we look at the text from chapter 11 through chapter 14, that's what we conclude. So that's what I've grouped these together in our studies. I have put them together. And so our intention, after we finish up this evening on our next study, is to go to chapter 14. We got more problematic things that are very much related to what we see here of authority and submission in 1 Corinthians 11. Then our aim will be go to chapter 12, and we're going to see what spiritual gifts can do for the congregation of the Lord's people, what their aim is, what the purpose is, and what they need to do with them, and how each of them need to work together. And then we'll finish it all up with chapter 13, because it all hinges upon the love. Now abide these three, he concludes at the very last of 1 Corinthians 13, faith, hope, and love. And of course, the third of these that remains forever is love. Well, that's going to be our plan. But this evening, we're going to finish up our study here in 1 Corinthians 11 in respect to authority and submission. Why do I say that? Because the subject is very plain. 11 verse 3. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is head of the Christ. And therefore, this is the point. And everything else is subservient to that. One of the other challenges that we have, though I'm going to submit to you my belief, and that is that really contextually, as I'm putting together, I believe that 1 Corinthians 11, in this part here, is a public assembly. But there's nothing in the text that demands that. Okay? So we need to be very careful. We just assume some things and jump to conclusion. Well, later on at the end of the chapter, he talks about the Lord's Supper. So therefore, it must be. No, this is a letter written without chapters and verses originally. And Paul had a lot of things to say to them. And I'm going to stress to you this evening as we conclude that authority and submission has no boundaries. It has no walls. Where did we get the notion that authority and submission would only apply in certain places? Authority and submission applies everywhere in our walk if we're children of God. And so I'm going to conclude that that is not absolutely necessary, that there's a public or worship assembly that the Christians have come together in chapter 11, verses 1 through 17 or 16. However, I'm putting it together with this because I also believe that it does include that setting. It's not exclusive, is my point. But it certainly is inclusive, therefore it's pertinent. All right. So let us, again, finish up what we're looking at with the problems, the circumstances. And one of the things that we need to appreciate is that in the New Testament, as well as even the Old Testament, though it doesn't... It isn't our authority for how we do things, obviously. But when we talk about authority and submission and the hierarchy, that's something that's always been true throughout the ages. You know, like we talked about with elders. You know, though we don't, they didn't have the church as we know it in the Old Testament, they did have a hierarchy, they had a structure, and they did have elders. And those elders had a special responsibility and a job, just as the priest did, and such as the high priest, and each person, and of course they had a king, and all these persons had responsibilities, and you had to be subject to them and according. And furthermore, when it comes to the subject of men and women, and husbands and wives, we've already noted from Genesis chapter 2 at the very beginning, there was already authority structure. He says in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, that he wants the man, to leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, which would be a husband, of course. Right? And therefore, as we've said that earlier in that text, as he caused a great sleep to come upon Adam, he took from him a rib and made woman. And when Adam was aware or awakened, he says, indeed, she will be called woman because she came from me, or hey, man. See, so we already understand that, and that will be found throughout the Scriptures. And when we get into the discussion of veils, which will be one part or component of this, and the application of this, we need to understand it in that context. But again, submission is everything. Furthermore, I have supported the fact that the veil, throughout the Scriptures, demands a full-on covering. You're not going to find anything short of a complete covering. And the head, as it would be described in that context, always meant from the shoulders or the bottom of the top of the shoulders, the neck, all the way to the top of the head in every case. And that's what it meant. It's the same word used when they curtained the Holy of Holies and the holy place. That's the same word, veil. And you're not going to find anything else. So, again, not to dissuade anybody from the practice, but to encourage you to rethink it and understand that if you want to do that, or if you believe you need to do that, or your family believes that, then I'm going to caution you to go for the full. Because if it is commanded, I want all of it. One of the other things that we're going to notice here is that, and I will make this statement, it is a principle of truth. Anytime God has something specific for us to do and He demands and commands us to do it, He gives us all the details and information. Yeah. We're not going to be left with any doubt. Nobody's going to be able to say, well, you know, any area He gives us judgment, of course, we have room. And then there's a lot of times debate sometimes in that, and hopefully it won't be to dissension or strife. But the bottom line is He gives us all the details that we need in order to do it well. For instance, when we talk about and head coverings, as it were, applied to the priesthood. You know, Leviticus will tell us about the head garb that was given to the priest. For instance, notice with me in Leviticus, let's back up to Exodus chapter 28, Exodus 28, verses 31 through 43. We'll just read a few sections, parts of that. He says, you shall make the robe of the ephod all of blue, and there shall be an opening for his head in the middle of it. And he shall have a woven binding around all of its opening, and the opening a coat of mail so that it does not tear. And he talks about the hems, and he talks about the all the aspects of it. Then he says, in Leviticus chapter 8 and verse 9, and he talks about how it's to be made, and it'll sanctify Aaron, it'll consecrate him and his sons for the ministry of priest, as we saw in Exodus 28. Then in Leviticus chapter 8 and verse 9, he says, and you'll put a turban on his head. And that turban on its front will have the golden plate and the holy crown of the Lord has commanded Moses. This thing was very particular, and you knew exactly. They knew exactly what the turban looked like. We can duplicate that even in drawing. That's why sometimes you will see, I've done that before, others may, put those up on slides. You know exactly what they look like. You know what their outer garments look like. You knew what their inner garments looked like because He gave us great detail. You knew what the turban looked like. That was true of the ark. When God says, this is what I want, He gave Noah's explicit instructions. And so even to this day, at least somewhat, you know, I may question whether or not it had the vessel-like look or structure, but in essence, as I understand it, they have one up there in Kentucky that's the same dimensions that you read of here in the Bible. And if you go up there and look at that, you can imagine the massiveness of that. But the point is, Noah knew exactly what God wanted without exception. Nobody was debating it. It was in full detail. And time and again, you will see this. When it came to their clothing for worship, as we said in the old, when it came to Noah's instructions, when it came to the building of the ark, when it came to the first century church, and He wanted to tell us exactly what would put us in, or Christ on us, or us put on Christ, I should say, then what did He tell us? He gave us every detail. There was nothing that was left out. We knew exactly what would save us according to God's plan. When He said, I will build my church, and later on describes what that church looks like, there was no doubt that what the church was to do in its work and its organization. No question about that. Its work and its organization was very clear. There was nothing that we had to sit here and debate about. Now, I know men have perverted that and corrupted that, but there was nothing that was left unsaid. We know exactly what to do in worship. We know what to do in organization. And those who of us who do it will do it according to that pattern if we do it according to God's will. But here, what's a head covering? Well, we know it's a covering. What does it look like? How large is it? How much does it cover? Does anybody know? Anybody question? I've seen it all over the place. I've told you. I've seen it a full covering. I've seen a partial covering. I've seen just little parts. I've seen it everything imaginable. It's been left to the imagination or the discretion or the understanding of every individual family that I've ever seen. I've seen it all over the place. But I do know this, that He has told us something about submission. I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man. The man is the head of every woman, and God is the head of Christ. I know that. And I also know, as we complete, that when it comes to praying and prophesying, as described here for us, there's something to do. That apparently, now, we can debate on the location. I'm not sure. That's why I say I wouldn't believe that it would have to be exclusive to a public assembly, but it could include that. And no matter how that bothers our senses, this praying and prophesying is an active work. It's not a passive work. What you would have the man to do, the woman would do also. Why? As verse 4 and 5 tells me, every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. But every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, for she is one and the same as the woman whose head is shaved. In other words, it's disgraceful to her. That's what it means. That's what it amounts to. It is something inappropriate. It would be significant that people would notice it and say, there's something not right here. Even she would recognize that. That's the point. It's appropriate according to the cultural terms, I would understand it, and we'll talk more about that. But the bottom line is that what the man's doing, the woman's doing, and if we've already stated the prophesying is not a passive action, how in the world would praying be? I understand I can pray passively. If you lead me in prayer like we had a while ago, I can pray with you. But there is no way that I'm going to, assuming we had those gifts, prophesy with you if you're prophesying. Either you prophesy or I prophesy. If I can't prophesy, I can hear you prophesy, but you have to say something so that I can hear it. It has to be spoken to me, or in the case of writing, being written down. So at any rate, it is a simple but basic truth that whatever happens in respect to the man has to happen in respect to the woman likewise, because that is the terms that are set forth. And I know it'd be difficult for us to understand, but we know the first century had spiritual gifts, unlike we do. And we know that he was not exclusively given those to men. We've already noted that. Joel would prophesy about it in chapter 2, verses 28. Acts 2 would repeat, Peter would repeat that on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2. We know that Anna was a prophetess even during the days of Jesus when he was a lad, when he was a young boy, and she prophesied in the temple. You know, was she covered? I don't know. You don't know. Didn't say. I'm not going to argue against it nor for it. No more than I would anyone else. And the Old Testament has examples after examples of women, and we've studied with the kids, and Deborah is a prophetess. She's the only one among the judges listed. And by the way, she's the only female judge, and she's also a prophetess. Guess what? She prophesies. Does she have her head covered? I don't know. And I know it's not our final say on anything just because what they did in the Old Testament. But I will say, if we keep it in context to the structure of authority and submission, then there are things that are timeless. If we're going to argue today we do something that they did then in regards to authority and submission, I'm going to submit a maxim. The authority and submission rule has never changed since God created man. Never. Does it have circumstances of application that vary and differ? For sure. Always has been. But it never changes because it's always the truth.
that God is an authority and then He decides who will exercise whatever authority He has given. Be in the case of Deborah, that He gave the opportunity and privilege of being a prophetess, or Anna, or whomever, or the high priest's family and who that would come from, such as Aaron. It doesn't matter whether it's male or female, He decides those matters. And then there is the concrete truth of authority from the very beginning, showing the structure of man ahead of woman. Not a man who is to be tyrannical in any way. We're not going to see that in the Scriptures. We may see examples of that, but we don't see that as being a privilege of man. But there still is a hierarchy, beginning at Genesis chapter 2 and verse 21. Man is ahead of woman, for woman came from man, and man named her woman, or called her woman. So in the case of 1 Corinthians 11, I believe the Corinthians knew exactly what Paul was calling a head covering. That I'll submit to you, and I believe you should believe the same thing. I have no doubt they knew exactly what to do and could do it according to what Paul had instructed them in regards to praying and prophesying. May I also suggest to you, where the praying and prophesying comes in is very important, because that is critical. It's not generic, it's specific. It covers some type of practice of worship that was applied. The praying and prophesying would involve divine revelation. Prophesying by nature is divine revelation. But I'm going to argue in this particular case, because praying is alongside it, it also is divine revelation or divine prayer or spiritual prayer. They had it in the first century. How do I know? Because I learned time and again as we walk through the pages of the New Testament, and especially in Acts and the epistles, we see that the first century church had those gifts or powers that we do not, as we will finally conclude in 1 Corinthians 13, that are no longer necessary. So regardless of what we want to think, praying and prophesying would be done in a proper way, which would include the timeless principle of authority and submission. It would have to. It wasn't going to be set aside for that time. We need to appreciate, as we look at 1 Corinthians 11, and when he talks about the fact that the angels in heaven, as he puts it, you need to do it because of them. Now that's a challenging text in part, because there's really only two possible applications that make any sense at all. And then in number one, it's because the angels in heaven are in their midst. And you know what? The Scriptures teach that God of heaven is in our midst as we are worshiping, as we're singing, as we're praying. And the angels of heaven as ministers of God, they're not physical, we know that. We're not going to see them with these eyes, but that's a possibility. That he's saying, to show the good example, you don't need to show a bad example before those heavenly servants. That's an option. The other would be just a fair warning, as Paul might be saying, remember what God did to the angels in heaven that did not keep their proper place? Jude tells us about that, doesn't he? He talks about the angels in heaven that wouldn't keep their proper place, of which Satan, the devil, was one of them. And they, of course, were cast out of heaven. That's a possibility. You choose. I don't know. Either one, according to the sentence structure and the clause, allows for either one. And either one of those makes sense. Okay? And then, if not to already take care of the problem that I've been talking about, submission, verse 8 will conclude as further evidence. For he says in verse 8, man did not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed, man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Again, stressing what I've already said in Genesis chapter 2, verses 21 through 24. Paul's hearkening all the way back and drawing that in. The other thing that we need to understand is that by the time we get to the end of the text, and he says very plainly in verse 16, but if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, nor have the churches of God. What is he saying? Is he looking back to verse 15 and saying, well, we don't want to be contentious, so we have no practice about women wearing long hair and that being her glory? And no, he's looking back, so the sentence hasn't finished. He's looking all the way back to the discussion of the covering. Because he says in verse 13, judge for yourself, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Proper, impropriety. It can be a very cultural thing. When he says proper, he don't mean lawful or sinful or other things of that nature. He's talking about propriety. He's talking about that which is proper. That's why he would utilize the actual hair, which would just be an illustration. It doesn't make for her covering literally in this context. In other words, her long hair wasn't going to do if she was praying and prophesying. That's the point. But it does illustrate something about propriety. Because he says the long hair for women naturally is their beauty. And you'll see that throughout the Scriptures, the locks of hair. You know that by observation. You know it by nature. You knew it by Scriptures. Ever read the Song of Solomon? You read about women in the Bible. We already observe these things. And we understand the nature of beauty. And therefore, it is a glory to her. It is her grace. And yet, the men, it is not so. Notwithstanding the challenge we have of the Nazarite vow and other things like that, because we learned that in the days of the judges, for instance, Samson would have long hair and be told to have it, as other Nazarites would have it, that would take that vow. God did make it exclusive for a group of persons, men in particular, in order to do service before Him. That doesn't, again, make it authoritative in all other cases, or it doesn't answer the problem and say, well, therefore, because men have long hair back then it negates this ideal of the practice here. I do believe that the cultural practices would also include this hair. As he points out, they would know something in the first century about short hair and long hair and what is appropriate, what is acceptable in society, just like we. Even if we violate it. And any time we violate some natural habit or practice of society, it doesn't make it authoritative. It doesn't make it right if we change those rules as a society, particularly because societies are godless, right? They're not necessarily serving God. So that cannot make it the rule. It simply shows us by those who are discerning, according to the text, you can pay attention. You can see what's appropriate. It's not what all society sees. It's not what all of man and society sees. It's what these first century Christians, particularly in Corinth, can know and know well. And so that's why it's utilized as an illustration for us. Therefore, he says in verse 10, and this is probably one of those parts of the text that oftentimes is used as a primary argument for the sake of wearing them, she ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, and then, of course, we've already talked about because of the angels. But the symbol of authority on her head. All right? At what time should she have a symbol of authority on her head? Most will argue in the assembly. Does that mean there has to be no reference to authority or recognition of authority in any other context or any other place? If I'm going to complete this understanding and suggest, if I were to come to the conclusion that it would be necessary or at least safe and appropriate, you know what's going to happen in my household? There would be a no occasion inside this assembly, outside this assembly, anywhere, that the ladies of my household would not be wearing the head covering all the time. Because when do they need to show that they're under authority? Then? Or you see the argument? It makes it simple. It helps us to understand. It does have context in the praying and prophesying, going all the way back to that, because there's something she can do and function. And I realize how challenging it is to imagine that, well, how would you do that in assembly? And then second of all, how do you reconcile it with chapter 14? We'll get there in chapter 14. But for right now, regardless, sometime, somehow, someplace, it has to do with praying and prophesying. And that's when, because there apparently is an assertion of authority.
There's someone or some ones among the female class who have usurped the authority of men, and the men have allowed it. They've said nothing about it. And Paul says you've got to put a stop to it. We cannot have that because you know better than that. And I need to stop that because otherwise this church is going to be heading to apostasy very quickly. You know, again, some will argue it's a custom of the Corinthians. I'm not sure about that. Societal, they were just as wicked as any others. I would make the case that it would be appropriate in every one of the New Testament churches, though it was obviously a concern here, in context to praying and prophesying. In other words, this head covering or symbol that would be separate and apart from the hair, when a person of the female persuasion among the Christians was given the prophesying work or the praying work, would have to have their head covered in every case, whatever that occasion may be, because of the very special and unique circumstances of the miraculous gifts, which would eventually be done away with, and that aspect of representing authority would come to an end. And there would be no need for it any longer. All right? Women were to obey their role, keep their place while praying and prophesying. And women, therefore, would cover their head, veil it. As I said before, the only place, aside from somebody coming back to tell me exactly what they did, and I haven't found any literature or anybody to explain how that worked, the only conclusion I have is a full-on veil, because that's the only way that word is used in all of New Testament. And then when they did that, they could perform worship according to God's plan, respecting God's order of things from 1 Corinthians 11 and in verse 3. A few things that we need to conclude with as well. Verse 16, as I pointed out, the wearing of the veil, that word is the word, or tradition, maybe in your context, it's a word custom, one that I have saying practice. Verse 16, if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, custom, tradition, nor have the churches of God. That's not authoritative. That is not the same word that's used the first time when he says in verse 2, now I praise you because you remembered me in everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered to them. The traditions he's using there comes from the word of command. In other words, because he is an apostle of Jesus Christ and has the authority. Now take those two together from book as a bookends, you know, the top, the front end, the back end of that, and put those together in context. And first note, the first time he says there's a command and I'm thankful that you're keeping it. Okay? I am pleased to know that you're doing what you have received. All right? And then the last phrase of that context is, but if anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no other tradition, custom, nor have the churches of God. All right. Now, what did I say earlier? Obviously, there's people not doing what they should be doing, or else why would he have to address it? I don't think he's just stating a fact that, well, you know what? I know you're doing this, but let me make sure that I reiterate and tell you again. You look at the context, and with the problems in the church, it appears that they were not doing exactly what they should. But whatever they were doing, it says, when he says in verse 2, he gives praise for it. You're doing exactly, and you hold firmly to what I delivered to you. Does it sound like Paul delivered to them a head covering ordinance? It doesn't say anything about that if they weren't doing it. On the other hand, when he concludes the head covering ordinances, he says we don't have such a practice, which is an entirely different word, as I said before. And of course, it is the word we get for custom and tradition. So the first tradition, which is a command because he's an apostle of Jesus Christ, they're doing exactly according to his plan, according to what he delivered. He's thankful for it. On the other hand, he says now in conclusion to the things that we just said, you need to make sure that we don't have any such tradition or practice.
That's a lengthy discussion there when we look at verse 16, in which I don't know that we will have enough time, but the bottom line is that he's not binding whatever it is in respect to the head covering. That much we do know. He is binding everything in regards to authority and submission. He is binding that they do things, as we'll see by the time we get to chapter 14, decently and in order. There's no question about that. According to the role and responsibilities. And we have to conclude that. Secondly, the meaning in verse 13, when he says, judge for yourself, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head covered? That ideal of proper, the word that we get, it's for propriety, contemporary. In other words, in setting. He's saying in context, at this time, is that appropriate? You know, we might say, as an example, is it appropriate that you come in a t-shirt to worship God, the God of heaven? Now, we can get too particular about dress codes, suits, ties, etc., and I'm not trying to dissuade anybody from dressing up. So I'm not trying to suggest we shouldn't do that, but at the same time, we do know some things are not all that appropriate. If I came in flip-flops and a short and a t-shirt with names and or different things written on it, would that be very appropriate for this setting? That might be appropriate on my patio at home, but it's not here, is it? Okay? So we understand the context here. When he says, judge for yourself, is it proper? In other words, you can understand. You see what makes sense and is according to proper order, what people do, what people should do. And this is without context of saying you're bad or good or anything. We all understand what this means. Judge for yourself, he says. So therefore, the meaning of that is what is contemporary, what is according to the time, according to the circumstance, according to the situation, appropriate. What other way would you understand that? Do you get the impression that if you that you should already know? Because that's essentially what he's saying. I can know it's not appropriate to wear a t-shirt, shorts, and flip-flop to worship. But am I going to conclude I shouldn't wear a hat or do wear a hat or, you know, using that as an example? Would I know that that makes any sense? Does that sound appropriate? Would I know anything about head coverings? Is there a context in the contemporary culture and all the age that you have lived that would, you know, or would I have to go, well, should I do that? So I'm going to go find out, does that make sense to do? Do I have to go to the Scriptures to say, no shorts, no flip-flops? I'm already going to judge that, aren't I? It would be the equivalent of going to the funeral or the wedding that away. I'm not arguing in today's society, you don't have examples of that, but people who have very formal weddings and very somber funeral services, generally people dress decently. The common wear, by the way, today in our contemporary society, in this age, would be at least some dress slacks, khakis, and a nice collared shirt. I've seen that everywhere. But you know, when I was a kid, even the farmhands wore suits and ties to every funeral. I never saw anybody in a khaki wear and a nice dress shirt. I don't know, you know, I wouldn't say that that would be a bad thing necessarily, but they didn't do it, not in the 1970s, even up into the 1980s. I didn't start seeing that till the 1990s. And we're obviously not talking about immoral clothing, we're just talking about what is customary. But today, what is customary? You might go to those venues, those settings, those occasions, dress nicely according to the time of your age. Age, in other words, like the khaki and the dress shirt. And you may not wear a tie or suit. You see how you can judge those things? But if you were in 1950, 1960, and 1970, you wouldn't dare do it, would you? And those of you who are older, who grew up in that generation, and were young people and not kids, you knew it because that's how you did it. Just as girls in the 1950s till almost, depending on where you live, the mid to late 60s, never wore slacks to many schools in America. Now, I'm not here to condemn jeans or slacks, but I know my mother, She would have finished high school if she would have graduated in 1969. School she went to would not allow women to wear until 1972. This would start coming into my area. Every picture you'd ever see in those days, dresses for the young ladies, from little to grown. In my day, you couldn't have facial hair. Couldn't have your shirt untucked. I remember my senior year. I got a razor from the vice principal to shave my face a couple of times. Because I could grow facial hair then, just enough for it to be seen. I had my shirt untucked a few times. They went in. Three violations of that, I was sent home for a few days. That's mid-1980s, guys. It was what was customary at that time. It was what was appropriate. That's my case for this argument. As you look here, what is appropriate and customary? Again, judge for yourselves. When? For the time that you live in. You're not going to think it's strange that somebody goes to a funeral or a wedding without a suit or a tie. If they're not in the wedding party in particular, they may not. You're not going to say, oh, look at them. But if they showed up in one of those where people are dressed nicely, at least in khaki slacks, as I said before, and maybe the women wearing skirts or dresses and a nice shirt, you're not going to be shocked. You're going to go, ooh, what are they doing? But if they showed up in a pair of shorts and flip-flops and a t-shirt to your wedding ceremony or your parents' or your family's funeral, you might think something about that. You may not say nothing, but you certainly might think something about that. And if they did that, they should feel, as he points to this argument, judge for yourselves. You know what makes sense. That's another way of putting it. What's appropriate? 3. Unveiled was just like being shaven. It's a disgrace. It's shameful. That's what he says to the woman. He says, for if a woman does not cover her head, verse 6, let her also have her hair cut off. Would she agree to that? Yeah, might as well just shave your head. A woman who likes her hair at all, who might be trying to buck the system of the day and say, no head covering, I ain't wearing it, I don't care. Well, if that's what you're going to do, go ahead and shave your head. No, I wouldn't do that. That's the point he's making. He's saying there's an equivalency here. He's saying, in this context, if you don't have the head covering, that is disgraceful, just like you know for sure by judgment that your hair are being shaved off when you're a woman who should have hair or you would think that you would want to have hair, and because all women have hair and that is part of your beauty, you wouldn't do that. I understand that modern day there are examples of that and some appreciate and like that. That's a whole different argument. Again, the problem with the society is not the way that we judge things. But what we can understand overall since the beginning of time, and that's where I think that I have settled that understanding in my mind, is that a woman was going to be challenged in this first century church. Well, if that's how you're going to act and you don't respect the submission based upon the work that you have to do, then you might as well just shave your head. And they would think, oh no, ain't going to do that. It'd be shameful. Okay? If you're not going to do that, then you need to respect this. That's the equivalent. And furthermore, just as an aside, I don't know if it's a complete aside, but isn't it interesting, if we're going to put the head covering on that plane of command, why not foot washing and holy kisses? Now we understand contextually that holy kisses was a form of greeting in the first century church, whatever that was, cheeks or whatever the case may be. It was a form of greeting, intimate greeting, more than just generic. So maybe we hug. Maybe we embrace and shake hands much more intimately and vigorously than we would just somebody we are meeting in a business deal. Whatever the case may be. But again, why not the holy kiss and the foot washing? Why are they customary for the time and the head covering has no connection to those? Sounds interesting to me to investigate. I believe that you have a correlation between them. And then finally, the divine law for all time, I think, approaches the problem. The divine law of all time, going back to 11 verse 3, I can't say it enough. I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ.
Therefore, that meaning of prophetēo or prophesying, it has deep and abiding meaning because they are proclaiming the Word of God. Don't you think that that should be a most respectful moment in which there is that distinction? God says, you're going to give my divine words. You're going to tell my words wherever that is. Wouldn't that be important? And if praying and prophesying, number two, I think they have to be connected because you have praying or prophesying. That means both of them are obviously in an inspirational moment. They apply to the man. They apply to the woman. And three, any covering can be substituted for the veil. Any covering can be substituted for the veil. Why? We don't know. We don't know what that veil is. Now, I've already told you the more prominent idea would be like going back to the curtain of the temple and the use of it in Old Testament context. But aside from that, did you know that the New Testament veil discussion is only found right here? What is it? What does it look like? And if I've already stated that God gives us explicit and specific instructions for what He wants us to do so that we have no doubt and we should not have any debate about exactly what we do to be saved and to work and worship, then He would have given us very specific instructions if that was necessary. And the position will not allow for the woman to do when she's veiled what Paul would allow. In other words, Paul allowed certain things, but anything that she had to do had to be in the context of veil. And so therefore, guess what? Whether it was praying and prophesying, if it's generic, if it's universal, then it goes beyond praying and prophesying. It's everything. It's going to market. It's setting in with men and women together. It's dining together. It's worshiping together. It's everything. Because she's going to be always seen if that is the symbol. But I believe it is the symbol in context of praying and prophesying, because that's explicitly told to us here in chapter 11, verses 4 and 5. And finally, as I've said before, she would have to wear it for all times. If there's a universal application, she has to wear it for all times, in all occasions, in all places. And the problem with that, and that doesn't mean it's primarily authoritative, I don't want to argue that, but it does have significance. Historically, there's no example. The church fathers don't talk about it explicitly and say this is what they did. We don't see it as a church tradition. As I said before, it's not our final say, but it does tell us a lot about the practice. It didn't happen throughout the history of the church. It wasn't a common thing. It wasn't written about. Not in this way. It wasn't something that continued as a practice, so it doesn't even reach back far enough to show that there's historical context. And I would say that if it were so, that we would see it and we would understand it that way. But as I conclude, I want you to be reminded as we get ready for chapter 14 to think about this. And this is the important part. It is more important than anything else I had to say technically this evening, and that is this. That what God is wanting the Corinthian church to do, that we should do, that applies to us, is everything that causes the building up of the body of Christ. And that means everything that's required, you do it. Everything that makes for that, you're going to make sure it happens. If it's something that's customary, you're going to make sure it happens because that's going to help the church be built up. It's not going to tear it down. If it's commanded, you're going to make sure it's there, not just because of commandment's sake, but also because you want to build up the body of Christ and you want a relationship with Jesus, you want a relationship with the Father, you want to go to heaven and you want everybody else to go with you. That's why you do it. That's why Paul would tell them these things. He didn't want outsiders to be saying, hey, I don't want any part of that. This group is just a messed up group. In fact, by chapter 14, we're going to find out. They're a very confused group, aren't they? And it's a disorderly group. And you don't know which way they're going. And so why would you want to be a part of that? And we don't want anybody to say that about us, do we? That's why it's important. That's why it's important to look at that and examine that. And then do it so that you help the church to be built up. Because that's Paul's aim. So finally, if you're here this evening and you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, may I encourage you to do so. And if you've done that and you've not been living as you should and you need the prayers of the congregation, I want to encourage you to confess and repent. Is it something that we can help you with that you need our prayers for? Please let us know. We'll be glad to help you in any way as we stand and sing. Amen.
God, come yet shall I rise.